I believe we got something going here.
I believe.
Okay.
Oh, all right, so I get to wear headphones and be professional. Well, professional dude.
That's kind of like taking your cue stick to the billiard table just because you're bringing your club.
I'm on a completely different channel. I'm listening to something else.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, but which is fine.
No.
Just make sure I'm being recorded because this could be the best show we've ever done ever. Like ever.
Try it now.
The best show ever. The best. Oh, all right.
That better?
I'm a professional with headphones.
Okay.
All right. So as we've been navigating the tour schedule for my time with Warner Brothers, we did a real quick 1979 episode, which was a lot of fun. And then we kind of turned around into 1980. And then we've been very fortunate to have some phenomenal guests.
Yeah, I know, man. It's fun when you and I can hang out. But, you know, David coming on recently and John Scott talking about Tom Petty. I mean, it's been a blast. But today, no guest. You just get Fred and I.
However, can I inject this? We had so much fun with John.
Yeah.
And his whole spiel was how he really fought for John Cougar, who became John Cougar Mellencamp.
Right.
And then obviously saved Tom Petty from being dropped from ABC Records, which they had their own, Tom Petty had his own definition of what ABC stood for.
Yes.
But so I told John Scott, I said, hey, listen, why don't we get John Mellencamp on the phone?
Wow.
And he said, I'll try.
So that's a possibility.
Yeah. He called him. He's a big oil painter. I don't know if you know that, but he, like, John Cougar Mellencamp likes to paint.
Right.
And from my understanding, he's very, very good at it. Which, by the way, the drummer of Red Hot Chili Peppers,
Chad,
he is a painter as well. And his art showing is traveling the country right now.
Right.
So for wherever you are, check whatever your local happenings are to see if Chad's show is in your area, because could be worth a visit to your art gallery.
From what I've heard, he's very accommodating to folks who come up and either purchase posters or actual paintings that he's happy signing and talking. And every city that he's visiting, he's very welcome to the fans and to share his other art.
You know, it's funny too, and I could see that because A, you already have a outlet in rock and roll, which is pretty phenomenal when you've reached the point where you are at that status of the people we're talking about on the show.
Right.
And then because they're these creative types, they have these other outlets that they probably start as a hobby. And then it starts to morph, like John Mellencamp and Chad and others. I mean, there's others. There's always been a story about Charlie Watts. From the very first time the Rolling Stones started to stay in hotels, he would trace that hotel in pencil, basically pencil and paper. And he does that to this very day. So now he's tracing huge suites.
And of course, look at John Lennon. I mean, he was an artist. I mean, some of his stuff, very simplistic, but sold for, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars.
You know? And you know what? When we get John Cougar Mellencamp on our show, we should really talk to him about his art.
Yeah.
Because that's now his new passion. So I think he'll enjoy talking about it and how he got into it. And so that'd be fun too.
You don't think he wants to talk about Hurt So Good one more time?
I have to tell you, I guess I'm not going to spoil it and tell our listeners what we're going to ask him. But I've got some great questions. And I don't think he's been asked these questions. So that's always a relief for an artist who hears the same stuff over and over.
Let's jump back into kind of picking up where we were when we were last together without a guest.
Yeah.
And we had crossed over the threshold of the 80s, and we started talking about some of the stuff you worked at the beginning of 1980. So I think that's a good segue into today's episode.
Yeah. So what I did is I looked at the charts, and I pulled up Billboard Top 200 for 1980. And the very first week was, what's your paper say?
January 5th, 1980. So we're talking 40 years ago, right?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yes, that is right.
Oh, my gosh. 40 years ago, these were the top albums on the Billboard Top 200 chart.
And we were turning the corner of 1979 for Warner Brothers, because that's the company I had worked for, and Sire Records and Island Records and Bearsville Records and ECM.
Well, I think this is really relevant, too, because, I mean, literally, you're talking the first week of a new decade,
which
40
is,
years ago. Yeah. And then, of course, we just entered a new decade as well with the 20s. So it's going to be kind of fun to go over some of these acts who were actually on the charts at that time and see how many still around.
Yeah. That'd be great. So here's what we're going to do. Warner Brothers and the Associated Labels had 21 albums on the charts for the very first week of 1980.
Right.
And that was Tusk, Fleetwood Mac was at 9.
Mm-hmm.
Neil Young, Live Rust was 20. Prince was at number 25, and that was the second album called Prince, and that was off of the, it was fueled by the single I Want to Be Your Lover.
And in today's standards, being at 25 sounds amazing. Especially the way that people buy CDs or albums these days. But was 25 considered a success for Prince at that early part of his career?
You know, that's a very good question, because everybody's goal is number one with a bullet.
Yeah.
And that is the creme de la creme. You're the top of the top. But top five is not shabby. Top 10, top 15. So it's almost like 25 is one of the kind of pinnacles. Did you have a top 25 album?
Right.
And then top 50, because you're still, you know, that's pretty strong. And at this moment, 40 years ago, when vinyl was it,
right,
and the only format, you know, you were selling millions and millions of records in America, and then Canada, and then Europe, and in Australia, and all over the globe.
What else did you have?
We had Little Feet, Down on the Farm was number 29.
Fun album.
It was. And I'll tell you, we had talked about this, me and you, our pronunciation of ZZ Top, Duguelo. And I'm sticking with that. You can call it, screw it up however you want.
I took Spanish in high school. It probably is Duguelo, which is what you are, the gayo.
You know, chances are they had made you go sit in the hall for a minute and calm down. So that was 37. And then Pat Metheny, American Garage, was number 60, which I think is kind of interesting because he's very much a jazz.
He's a jazz guy.
Yeah. So then we had Steve Martin, Bob Marley, Neil Young with another record, mm-hmm, Bonnie Raitt, Talking Heads, and the 10 soundtrack, which I definitely have a story to talk about. But I want you to tell our listeners the other albums of significance,
okay,
in 1980, the very first week.
Well, I can't wait to hear that story about the 10 soundtrack, because Bo Derek was on the wall of every young man across the world during that period. So that's going to be a fun story. I can't wait to hear that. So let's look at what number one and number two was and think about where we were at from a time period. We were ending up disco. We were starting more new wave bands,
yes,
the arena bands, if you will, the Journeys, the Foreigners of the world. But if you look at this, number one on the radio, Greatest Hits Volume 1 and 2, Donna Summer, number one, disco. What's number two? Bee Gees' Greatest Hits. See, what's happening here is what you said all along about how the record labels would have these greatest hits, because we're coming at the end of disco. Someone is pretty wise, knowing we better get these greatest hits albums out there before disco is completely dead.
Yep.
And they did. And look what happened.
And it was all money. A greatest hits album is all money.
Everything's done.
It's done. Everything's been produced.
So that's why you see number one and number two there. Moving on down, Styx with Cornerstone. Again, back to the arena bands, we have the Eagles coming in at number five. One of your favorite artists and mine, Stevie Wonder, is coming in at four with Journey Through the Secret Life of Plants, another great album. Then we have Led Zeppelin at six, The Wall from Pink Floyd at seven, Damn the Torpedoes from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers at number eight, Tusk from Fleetwood Mac at number nine. Then you're moving on into the head games from Foreigner, number 11. Jefferson Starship, Freedom at Point Zero with Jane, that song, 13.
I love that song, Jane. It's
a great
rocks.
Song.
It rocks really well.
And then you have such weird diversity like Rufus and Chaka Khan with Master Jam. You got R&B. You've got Kenny Rogers, who was kind of a country pop crossover.
Yep.
Then at 16, we're looking at Aerosmith with Night in the Ruts. And You know, I gotta say, I like the album. But not one of my favorites.
It wasn't their best record.
It literally took that Run DMC cover of "Walk This Way" to rejuvenate their career. I think the
absolutely
was really what brought them back.
That and Steven Tyler getting sober.
Yeah, yeah,
was absolutely. Huge.
Other stuff you mentioned: Neil Young with "Crazy Horse," "Live Rust" at number 20. Prince was at 25. Supertramp, "Breakfast in America."
I mean, that was huge.
That album still has at least three or four tracks that gets played on any classic rock station anywhere in America. It was a huge record.
It was their biggest of their career.
I listened to it every morning with my roommate. I'd never heard of Supertramp before. I went to college, and I definitely became very familiar with them immediately.
So where are you at chart-wise, number one?
We're almost up to 30. ELO's Greatest Hits.
I love ELO. I still do.
Gold and Platinum Skynyrd. Are you seeing a pattern here? Basically, we're coming off the Christmas holidays. The Greatest Hits are out there. I had Gold and Platinum from Skynyrd. Great compilation album. But you can kind of see exactly all the stuff you've talked about as far as how the record labels would get through the holiday rush and the Greatest Hits. We're seeing it play out literally scientifically on the charts exactly how you did it, and they did very well at that. Candy O from the Cars, you know, that was really
great
starting to take
album.
Off.
Oh my God, I love that album.
That one was coming in at 42. And then off of the Southern Rock of Skynyrd and Allman Brothers, and even Little Feat to a little bit, we have Molly Hatchet, "Flirting with Disaster."
Oh, that's right.
You know, which is a kind of rejuvenated Southern Rock.
I think they were on Epic.
Yeah. And then a little Pat Benatar, who's up for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. She's at 44.
40 years ago.
A couple more. Let me throw in here. Dream Police from Cheap Trick at 52. I mean,
now that was a huge
fun
album. Their career, too.
It was a fun album.
Yeah.
So that's just a little sample of what was happening 40 years ago on the charts. And it's kind of funny to actually legitimize the conversation that we're kind of pulling a little bit out of the crack of our ass on some of this stuff. But when you see the science there and exactly how we did it,
we can
be validated here, right?
All right. So I had half of my foot in Detroit and half in Houston because they gave me the blessing and the go-ahead to transfer in February of 1980. And then I kept going down to Houston to find a home. And the girl I was dating at the time, we were just starting to really get into it. And I said, man, I'm transferring. Do you want to go? And what was really weird was I was on the road with Todd Rundgren. And I remember you didn't have cell phones, so I would always tell my folks and Charl, my girlfriend at the time, where I was hotel-wise, so they could always at least leave messages. In fact, that was a normal thing. You would go to the hotel, and if you stayed at the same ones, which I did, you got to know them, they got to know you, and they actually were friends, and I loved those people. But they would have your stack of messages or faxes or whatever at the time for you to grab.
Yeah.
So you could see who's looking for you, and that's how people communicated. And I remember my mom had left a message and said, this is urgent, you need to come home. And I immediately, all the worst thoughts, my dad, her, what, my grandmother, what? I had three sisters. I mean, what? So I called her and she wouldn't tell me, but I went through the whole litany of, all right, who said, no one's sick. No one's hurt. No one's, it's just that something happened. It's easier if you just come home so you can see what it is. And I lived on the wrong side of 8 Mile and someone had broke into my home and absolutely ransacked it.
Oh, wow.
All my gold records, all my, I used to have this really cool setup where my albums were in this amazing case in this dining room where all three roommates had our albums. And we all had different sections of this dining room where we had albums everywhere. And a lot of them were on like bookcases. And then my cassettes were in drawers. So the people literally stole my drawers because the cassettes were right there. It was easy to carry out.
Yeah.
But it was the most violating I've ever felt.
Did you ever get any of those gold or platinum plaques replaced?
Yes, Warner Brothers is such a wonderful company,
nice.
And they replaced them all.
That's nice.
And if you look at a lot of gold records, to be honest, if you count the grooves and look at how many songs, sometimes they don't match up because they're not really the same record.
Right, right.
So that's just a little inside note. If you ever go to somewhere where somebody has a gold or platinum record, count the number of songs on the label.
True.
And then see how many grooves are.
Now when I go home tonight, I'm going to look at every one of mine just to see which are legit.
Speaking of groove, whenever my friends were bummed out, I go, dude, just pick up your needle and set it on another groove. All right. So I came home and I was really bummed. So I literally moved everything into my girlfriend's home. And in Michigan, you have basements. So I literally moved everything. I just would not stay in that home.
Right.
And it was the very first house I bought. I was 23, so I sold it immediately, put a for sale sign. And then I just said, you know, this is a new adventure for me. I love this company, and I'm planning on climbing the ladder of success. So I'm taking this job. It's a major market, Houston.
Right.
So I went to meet my boss, who was my regional, because we had David Kahn on.
Yeah.
And he was my regional in Detroit. Well, my regional in Dallas was Murray Nagel.
Okay.
And Murray's going to be one of our guests soon. And he's got so many stories that he could get me in so much trouble. I'm just going to have to mute him. But so I met with Murray and he picks me up. And I had been out on the road with Dire Straits and I had met this really cute barmaid. Who had a beautiful shag, yellow, or she had a blonde hair shag, and for some reason she ended up in my house for days.
Wow.
I know. And then when I finally sent her home, I had to get ready for this Dallas trip, and it was about 1 a.m, and I just kept itching in my private area.
Yeah.
And something was going on down there, so I grabbed the light next to my bed and put the sheets, and I look, and there's these little crab things cruising around.
So the shag had some crabs.
I guess so. So the only Walgreens that's open 24 hours was 25 miles away.
Wow.
So by 3 a.m, I'm there going up and down every aisle. The lights are fluorescent. I'm embarrassed. I don't even want to tell anybody what I'm looking for. So I'm trying to figure it out. I waste an hour of embarrassment and finally said, look, dude, I got something going on down there. And he goes, oh, here it is right here. He gives it to me. It's in a glass bottle. So he puts it in a bag. I get in my car, drive all the way home. By now, it's 4 a.m. It's still dark. I go to the back porch to unlock my door. And I had the glass bottle in the paper bag under my arm. And as I turned the key, my elbow took away from my side of my body and the bottle fell and broke into a million pieces on the patio. So my decision was, well, do I pull down my pants and just roll all over it?
Probably not the wisest thing to do in broken glass.
So I got back on my car, drove all the way back, got another bottle. Now I knew where it was, came right. back, and now the birds are chirping. The sun's out. And so I do what I'm supposed to do, and I go to the office and whatever. But I had to get on a plane the next day.
Let me just jump in real quick on the cure for the crabs. I could have saved you a lot of time there. And here's what you do.
What?
You
Tequila.
No. Basically, what you do is you go down and shave one side of your pubic area, right? You nice and clean. And then on the other side, you light up those with a lighter. And when the little crabs run to the clean side, you start stabbing them with toothpicks. And you're done.
That's like war. So Murray picks me up at the airport, and I'm exhausted. I haven't slept, and I'm embarrassed that I have this whatever I caught, and I was just not happy. He says, okay, so I made the guest room up at your house. And I go, oh, no, that's okay. I'm going to stay in a hotel. And he goes, what do you mean? And I says, well, I'm going to stay in a hotel, you know, my privacy. And he goes, no. I think it'd be nice if you stay. I said, look, I met a girl. Something happened. and I got something and I'm not happy with it. And he is already a hypochondriac.
Yeah.
So he thinks they're already crawling down my leg and up pant leg.
Oh, yeah.
That got us off to a really roaring start because we were, he's my brand new boss.
Yeah.
One of the first thing I have to tell him is so embarrassing. So I get my room and he goes,
"Hello, boss. I've got the crabs. Welcome."
So he says to me, "We have a jam-packed couple days and this is your new market. I want to introduce you to everybody at the branch." Because the Dallas was the distribution branch for WEA for that part of the country. So we had a party at the Playboy Club in downtown Dallas in a high-rise, you know, building. And it was the soundtrack to 10 with Bo Derek.
Oh, yes.
And our artist who sang the theme song was Christopher Cross. So we had, and that was a suit and tie kind of thing, and I'm not a tie guy. So, you know, I wore jeans and a really nice white shirt and a blue blazer.
Right.
And I looked good, by the way. And we proceeded to just get hammered. And my new partner was Jerry Barrett, the legendary Jerry Barrett out of Dallas. Mm-hmm. He was in a gray suit, a light gray suit and white shirt, and it was a fabulous party, and I couldn't have been more excited to be in a Playboy.
Were you done with the crabs at this point?
No, I still was putting
So you
that
were still,
stuff.
Oh,
Oh, so
man.
I was out of commission, so there I wasn't going to meet and greet anybody in my own room
for
a while.
Yeah.
But, it, you know, that took the pressure off because I was just there to have fun and meet everybody.
You talk about if you could visualize hell. You know, what is hell?
Go to a Playboy club.
Go to a Playboy club with the crabs and can't do anything with a girl.
And you have an open tab. You can do anything you want.
Well, you've been to hell and back, my
All right.
friend.
So Jerry Barrett had his eye for one of the receptionists. You know what? She was Murray's assistant. So she would be somebody we all talk to, especially if we're trying to get at him and he's on the phone or whatever. And she was a hot little number. And she kept flirting with me like hardcore. And I'm like, I'm not even going to tell you why. Yeah. I'm not going to flirt back with you. So it ends up where everybody gets hammered. And Murray goes home. He's got a wife and kids. He goes home. And he leaves me with Jerry. Well, Jerry goes, look, I've got to drive her. I forgot her name, but the secretary. I have to drive her home because she's hammered. And I don't want her to get in any trouble. So you're going to take my car and you're going to follow us. I was like, all right, fine. Well, one of the things I learned in the South Hemisphere versus the North Hemisphere is the sky is very different.
Oh, yeah.
So if you've never been in the Southern Hemisphere and you're from the North or vice versa, they're very different skies. And I was fascinated by how the horizon was in Dallas at night where all the stars, and it just looked really big.
Yeah.
The sky looked bigger. I don't understand why, and I guess a scientist would want to email us. You can, but...
It's on a billboard. Everything's bigger in Texas. Come on, you know that.
So I'm just fascinated with what's going on. I'm extremely excited. I'm following Jerry. Well, all of a sudden, he's driving erratically, and I'm going, oh my gosh. I knew he was drinking.
Right.
And it started to concern me. So he pulls over, and we're like in a subdivision. So imagine being in a subdivision, which is cool because there's no oncoming traffic. But he's still like making like a snake, and I'm trying to follow him, and I'm like, oh my God. So he finally pulls over, and he happens to pull over near like a street light. And all of a sudden, he gets out, and you see him in his gray suit, and he's got this huge wet spot.
Oh, no.
She was going down on him, and I could even, and I actually remember seeing head bopping up and down. And she gagged, and he got all of that in his crotch.
Oh, my God.
That was my first night in Dallas.
Wow.
And then the next night, Murray takes me to Fort Worth. And Prince was on tour with Rick James, Super Freak.
Yeah.
So, of course, when you're the record label, not only do you have laminate passes and all the other passes that you put on your leg and all that, but you have phenomenal tickets because you're the one buying the tickets and you're giving them to people. So Murray had two tickets, dead center, 15th row. Prince is opening, and he comes out with the black panties and the black trench coat.
Right.
And he's... masturbating the mic stand.
Wow.
And I'm like, what is going on here? And we are the only white people in the audience. We are like the hole in the donut. I mean, everyone's black or Hispanic or whatever. They've got
just
beautiful skin color.
You had good taste, man.
And we were just, we glowed in the dark, just so you know. And then when we meet him at backstage, he's so reserved and he's so introverted. And we're talking to him and he looks at his shoe and he moves his shoe in like a circle. And then he looks up to say something. Then he looks down. He doesn't make eye contact. So we told him he was great, blah, 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 and then kind of carried on. So that's my story.
So is there anything else? I know we talked about a lot of stuff in 1980. Were there any other albums that should kind of bring up for 1980 since we're in this year?
Yeah, here's what I did, and here's your list, and okay. Just kind of go over them. But so then I took the Billboard chart for the end of the year.
Oh,
so
very nice.
So we shared the very first chart in the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
And now that says what? December 27th.
1980.
Okay.
So a full year has gone by.
Yeah. So December. So now I'm in Houston. Mm-hmm. And the number one album was John Lennon.
Double Fantasy. Yeah.
And I have to tell you that when I got to Houston, we had Dire Straits just absolutely kicking it.
Now, just on the timeline, remember 1980. Was the year that John got murdered.
Here's what I want to do. I know we're probably tapping on 30 minutes, but I really want to finish this episode. For those of you, we try to keep your attention at 30, but hang in there because here's what happened. At the end of the year, we had 23 albums on the charts. Mm-hmm. And while I'm talking to them, go through like you did the other and see who's now out there.
Well, as you can see, we definitely have completely lost the disco. All the disco is gone. With the exception of Barbra Streisand, who worked with the Gibb Brothers on that album, Guilty. Which was at number two. But Barry still was the producer of that album. And, you know, it still had that element to it.
The back end of 1980, we had 23 albums on the charts. So Rod Stewart, Foolish Behavior is number 12. And remember, all these artists I was on the road with because that's part of the deal. That's how you keep an album going as they hit the road. Mm-hmm. Dire Straits, Making Movies, was 19. Doobie Brothers, One Step Closer. So they're coming off the Grammy Award-winning Minute by Minute.
Right.
So One Step Closer was at 20. Christopher Cross is at 23. Talking Heads, Remain in Light, was 29. And by the way, Chris Frantz's new book, Remain in Love, is coming out April of 2020, and he's going to be our guest. And we're going to be giving away some of his autographed books. Neil Young had Hawks and Doves. Record was number 30, but it really wasn't a great record. Devo, Freedom of Choice, 37. Leo Sayer, Living in a Fantasy, 38. Fleetwood Mac, 49. George Benson, Give Me the Night, 51. B-52's Wild Planet, 75. We had signed Paul Simon away from Columbia. So his album, One Trick Pony, I think it was called, was number 84. And then Prince Dirty Mind was 89. We also had Emmylou, Al Jarreau, Robert Palmer, Thin Lizzy, and the best of the Doobie Brothers. And then the Pretenders were just getting going on the charts. The debut album was just coming out. But to talk about John Lennon, it was unbelievable because when I got to the Houston branch, which was not a big warehouse, it was a satellite office. Everybody was really high on me coming there because there was this huge void of no Warner Brother rep for 6 months. And then we were on fire. I mean, we were literally on fire and some phenomenal bands. And of course, when we signed John Lennon, Double Fantasy on Geffen, which was now a new label for us to distribute along with Sire and Island and Bearsville and ECM, you know, it was amazing for me. The Beatles were it for me. I was, right. I mean, I was 8, 9 years old and my older sisters were into Meet the Beatles and I got caught up on the movie Hard Day's Night. And so now I am actually working a John Lennon record. We blitzed it to radio. I had everybody deliver the album at the very same time to Houston radio. And then December 8th, I get a phone call. And it's a phone call that I just can't even describe because, again, we don't have cell phones. We're not texting. This is all about a phone line. And they called me at home. I find out John Lennon had been murdered. I didn't even know what to think or do. And my girlfriend, Charles, who ended up becoming my wife, you know, we started talking and I started to, you know, bawl my eyes out. I just couldn't understand how a rock star who's done nothing wrong to anybody is just murdered on the streets of New York. It just was like, why? It was just such a shocking. And so then I called my partner in Detroit, Richard Woolard, the Warner Brother rep, because, you know, he was a hardcore pot smoker and he'd nod out about 8:30 at night.
Yeah.
So I knew he was sleeping and I woke him up and I told him what was happening. We like cried together. And then before you know it, I never went to sleep and the sun started coming up and I just started calling my morning shows, trying to get at my PDs and MDs that were doing a morning show. Plus they were the music director. And the shock of the conversation was so heavy that they started just putting me straight through on the air. And I found myself telling every city in my territory practically the same story.
Right.
And I'm repeating it. And the hairs on the back of my neck were standing up because it was when you're repeating something that you know is historical and it's going to remain historical forever. And you're now carrying the message. I don't even know how to describe what that's like.
Yeah,
it was a heavy load, which is why Double Fantasy was the number one with a bullet at the very last week of 1980 for us. And unfortunately, you know, the only album we had with him.
And it literally went from 11 to number one in 1 week. And of course, it should. December 27th, this is only 2.5 weeks after he was killed. I mean, the fans went out there and they bought that record and they bought it.
They did. And then one of the things that I have to this very day, and I've only shared it with a couple other friends of mine where I made copies and gave it to them, is radio station in New York. I think he was at WNEW or PLJ, but one of the big, big rock stations in New York did an interview. And it was a long interview. I mean, I think they had him on the air for about an hour, hour and a half. And so back in the day, again, without all of today's technology, the interview is transcribed like a court reporter would transcribe what happens in a court of law.
Right.
Bert Keen, my Warner Brother, you know, department head, ended up sending every single Warner Brother rep a yellow folder, unmarked, and in it you opened it up, and it was John Lennon's last interview he gave.
Wow.
And
which, from what I understand, was literally hours before he was murdered, right? It happened the same day. Didn't the interview happen the same day?
In fact, I think he was murdered when he came back from the interview.
Wow.
I think he was coming back. You know, and the historians can chime in because I didn't Google any of this for specifics. But I believe it was when he was coming back from the interview.
Wow. That's amazing.
So, unfortunately, we're kind of leaving this on one of our more sadder notes. But at the same time, I think for all good reason, we are. And again, thank you guys for listening. This show is absolutely blown up. The last few interviews we've had has taken our show to so many levels of success. And it's because of you guys, because we're so ground roots. None of these podcasts are recommending us. We're not to that level. But your reviews on iTunes, your reviews on Google Play, on our Facebook page, are incredibly important to us, and thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. We do appreciate that. And again, remember promotion-man.com. If you want to find out more about the podcast, you can get your smart speaker. Just say, Siri, play Promotion Man. She hops right on the Apple Podcast. If you've got an Echo device from Amazon, Alexa, play Promotion Man on Apple Podcast. It starts immediately.
Isn't there a male version now of Siri that the girls can talk to?
I think there is for Siri, but not for Alexa. She's holding court on her own.
All right. So you women, I don't know what yours is named because our girl is Siri, but
right,
whatever your boy's name, tell him.
Yeah.
Play Promotion Man podcast.
That's it. That's the way we roll.
Some bitch.
Promotion Man, the true backstories of the most iconic bands in the world, told by Fred Myers and interviewed by me, L.A. Lloyd. Get involved and interact on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You'll find the links at promotion-man.com. That's promotion-man.com. Download the weekly Promotion Man podcast on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Google Play, or your favorite podcast provider. We appreciate you subscribing and spreading the word, and thanks for listening.